Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangkang namasami. Well, the retreat is speeding along. And I guess today is the fifth day, I think. Could it possibly be the fifth day?
Yeah, fifth day.
Fifth day. Fifth day of the retreat. Literally seems like it just began. We've heard a lot of information and a lot of detail about the Buddha's teachings and the spiritual path. I thought maybe what I just talk about today or touch on is just trying to just bring it down to the absolute basics and try and just bring it down to some very simple kind of questions and reflections. A good question to ask yourself for those of us who are consider ourselves committed practitioners. So what is the path? You know, can you kind of summarize the path to yourself in a very succinct, simple, straightforward way? I think there's probably dozens of ways you can answer this, actually, depending on the individual. Certainly, in terms of meditation, a very nice way to just remember what meditation is all about is just bringing it down to these two basic concepts of samatha and vipassana. This is, of course, assuming the groundwork of the precepts of a basic sort of wholesome, harmless life. Samatha and vipassana it's a very useful kind of framework to hold your meditation. The word samatha, many of us should know or know the word. It means a calming or stillness. In the Vinaya, there's something called the seven adhikarana samatha. These are seven, in the Vinaya is the monastic code, the rules for the monks and nuns. And the seven adhikarana samatha is translated as the seven, ways of settling disputes or issues. Adhikarana is the word for issue, and samatha is to settle. So to settle an issue. So this word samatha is literally it's used in different contexts as just like to settle or to resolve something. So in our meditation, you can think of samatha as letting things resolve or letting things settle. Of course, there's many different methods and approaches to letting the mind settle. One of the things that many of us do too often, though, is this application of will, of sort of determination. We kind of sit down, fold our legs, and become very determined to still the mind. And in so doing, just kind of turn ourselves into a knot. And it becomes very unpleasant. So it's sort of like if you think of a bathtub with some water in it and you want the water to settle down, the best way to do it is to just let the water be. And initially if the water is stirred up, it'll kind of move back and forth for a while. But then in time, the water in the tub just begins to kind of soften and kind of slow down and until it starts to settle. And then eventually it becomes still. And so that's very much what we have to do in our meditation. At least this is one very good approach, is to be able to simply stand back with this sort of spotlight of mindfulness, of awareness, and just stand as far back as we can from our mind and our body and just let the whole thing be exactly what it is. And if we're not adding fuel to the fire, if we're not stirring up the bathtub, if we're just standing way back with this bright, attentive awareness, then all the energy and the sort of the eddies and the whirlpools of the mind just begin to settle and to quieten. The trick is, of course, you have to not kind of get in there and stir the pot, and this is tricky. But nevertheless, that's what we have to do. Just a slight change of track here a little bit. Ajahn Pasano has been touching on the Four Noble Truths, been going into the Four Noble Truths. And this is something that we have to bear in mind. Why is it that we're even doing this in the first place? What brings us to the meditation, to the 10-day retreat, when we could be on holiday somewhere, we could be just hanging out with our friends, whatever. And what it is, I think, inside of us is there's a sense for most of us that there's something, a sense of incompleteness, this sort of intuition that despite all the different things that we can pursue in life and achieve and acquire, there's something kind of embedded in the structure of our entire life that seems to sort of conspire against a sense of contentment and completion. I know the Stoics have this term, what is it? Hedonic adaptation. And it's this basic idea that whatever it is that might bring you happiness or pleasure, so let's say like a new house, you want to get a new house, thinking that this new house is going to something exciting, something that's going to be inspiring to you or bring you happiness. And you get the new house, and it's kind of nice for a while, but then after a while it begins to become invisible. It simply provides a background for your existence, and it becomes like a baseline. And what you've done in this sort of Stoic terminology is you've hedonically adapted to the house, and what you previously thought was going to bring you happiness has now become completely invisible to you, and it's no longer even part of, you're not even aware of it. And then you go on to something else. You think, well, maybe I need a new car, and you get into your new car, and then pretty soon you hedonically adapt to that, and then that's invisible. This can go on to just almost, you know, extravagant extremes. You think in terms of raises, and I remember the whole sort of bailout. Remember that kind of financial, you know, fiasco that went on. It's still going on about the bankers who can make millions of dollars in 1 year and then get, you know, like this kind of ridiculous Christmas bonus of like $5 million or something like that. And it's something similar where it's like you start off getting maybe a small bonus and then you adapt to that and you think it starts to become the baseline, and then you expect a bigger bonus, and then that becomes a baseline, and then you expect a bigger bonus, and then that becomes a baseline. We're forever adapting to the things that we get, and then that becomes our sort of background, becomes an invisible background. So this is a real sort of dilemma, because there's no escaping this. It's even in the realm of relationships, there's a certain person you kind of set your eyes on, and you want that person to be your partner. And then if that person becomes your partner, at first it might be wonderful, it might be everything you dreamed of, perhaps in the best of worlds. But then after a while, you adapt to that. And that becomes a new baseline, it becomes invisible. And then you want something more, or you want something else. What this points to basically is the flaw of craving, this movement of the heart that has to be settled. And of course, the one thing that we have hedonically adapted to in the most extreme sense is this human body. Although I can't speak to this directly, but I very much assume and believe that there's probably a point where just upon just acquiring the human body, it's just one fantastic thing. 80 years of adventure and becoming, and so much potential, so much experience to be had. This incredible thing, and it's so new and it's so fresh and so much vitality. And that's how life starts. And you can see it in a newborn baby's eyes. I mean, it's just, it seems to be just so alert and attentive and fresh. And then 20 years down the road, and it's just like, well, you know, big deal. So what? You know, you've got this body is here, and it just seems to be like the baseline. And you completely take it for granted, and you tend to almost assume that... well, you essentially identify with the body, and you begin to think that this body is actually who you are. And so in our meditation practice, this is where we want to use the tools of samatha and vipassana to uproot this adaptation, as it were. And the reason we have to uproot it is because fundamentally the truth of the matter is, according to the Buddhist teachings, is that, well, nothing is ours, actually. Not the house, not the wife, not the husband, not the kids, not the job, and not this body. And it's actually fairly easy to say these things. A good example is like your possessions. It's actually fairly easy, I think, to look at your possessions and say, yeah, I understand. I get the point. You know, possession is simply a human construct. It's something. It's an agreement, and our society basically agrees that this house belongs to me, but actually, it doesn't. Okay, that's fairly easy to see. But if the house burns down, it's a different thing altogether. So too with the body. I think, it's interesting. Some people say it's easy to see the body as not self. I'd consider myself one of them. To me, it's not that difficult to just see the body as being part of nature. It just feels, it's very easy to just think of it as part of, just like the trees. It's a part of, it's appeared and it's growing old and it's dying and it's out of my control. But I can say that, but then it's also very clear to me that when I get very sick, I can get very distressed. Or if I'm in pain, I can be really challenged to cope. And certainly if I am confronted with death, which does not happen very often, but I know that if I'm confronted with death, it's a different situation than if I simply try and imagine myself being confronted with death. So this whole, the way that the attachment to the body is something that goes very, very deep and far deeper than our intellect can easily access. So the meditation of samatha and vipassana is one of the tools that we have to really go at this attachment and to uproot that attachment. There's many different teachings out there that will talk about different aspects of the mind and is emptiness, and different aspects of emptiness, and different truths on different levels. And I think that. I think that often this can be misleading because underneath so many of our investigations does lie this attachment to the body. And that's why in Theravadan Buddhism so much emphasis is put on understanding this form that we're born with. It seems to, we've come into this world and there's this incredible thing that seems to be here and doesn't seem to make sense. It just seems to have come from nowhere, And there's this sense of attachment to it, and we don't really understand how that's come about. And all the different intellectual and even perceptual, I mean, it's not just the onto the level of intellect, different insights that we can have into the nature of existence and the nature of a phenomena can really be missing the point. And it can even be distracting. There's a question that was asked, why is there something rather than nothing, earlier on. Sort of the classic philosophical question. And that's a great example of something that, you know, you could spend a lifetime, in fact, many people have spent lifetimes analyzing that question and basically getting nowhere in terms of their attachment to the body, in terms of this fundamental attachment to this human body, which is a source of karma, which is a source of decision. And it's what keeps the wheel going. It's this attachment to this body. So in the Vipassana, we use this groundwork that we've developed through samatha. Samatha, which is simply an aspect of learning how to let the body be, learning how to let the mind be, just stepping way back and just letting it be completely free and still. And this isn't to be confused with enlightenment in any way. You can't get enlightened through just getting super still. If only it were that easy. But it's that stillness that provides a groundwork for a lot of skillful insight. And it provides strength or flexibility of mind so that you can start investigating the body in a much more thorough way than you can if you're just sort of sitting at a desk or kind of thinking things through in other circumstances. When we investigate the body, there's many different sort of angles. Some are easier to access and easier to explain than others. The easiest one, probably the most accessible one, is contemplation of death. And this can simply be something very simple, such as using as a mantra, say on every out-breath, I will die, or this body will die, this body will die. And then just investigate what comes up as you kind of say that to yourself, sitting there with the body, in a state of calm, even a state of bliss that comes up from the samatha, and then just contemplating this body will die. This body will die. It's also useful to look at the body, use your visual capacity to see the body in a different way. You see, because we take the body to be self, we don't really have any perception of what it is. It's just the place from which we act, and we don't really look at the nature of what the body is. What is it made of? How is it working? And that's a very fascinating and interesting perspective, and it changes your sense of what the body is. So just to, when you're sitting here, just as if you could look through the body with X-ray eyes, and you can just see through it, and you can see the veins and the blood and the bones, the nerves, the lungs, different aspects of the body. And it starts to, what you previously thought was you suddenly see as simply an organism, just like any other organism on the planet. With its nerve and the brain and the neurons firing, and instead of you thinking thoughts, you know, somehow independent of the brain, you realize this is an organism that is breathing, thinking, I'm sorry, breathing and neurons creating thoughts. It's quite remarkable. When people do meditation on the body like this, they'll often find certain aspects of the body to sort of stand out as being extra remarkable. For me, I've always found, if I may say so, the brain is an incredible thing to visualize. You're just sitting here and reflecting that there's a brain in the head being fed with blood and with neurons firing. And that changes my perception of the body somehow. Another one is blood, picturing blood moving around through the veins and carrying oxygen, picking up oxygen from the lungs and distributing it to the different parts of the body and returning to the lungs with carbon dioxide. There's such a sense that it's an organism. And at first it's just simply fascinating, but you don't want to get caught up in the fascination of it because we're not trying to just get fascinated. But what it does is, if you can simply dwell on this and let the mind settle into it, it eats away at the sense of self that we attach to the body. The sense that this body is somehow mine, is somehow under my control. The truth of the matter is that what we see of the body is simply, it's just, we've created this image of the body informed by mass media, romance novels, advertisements, this image of the body that is simply not what it is at all. It's a very sort of organic, earthy machine. So this, at the fundamental, at the heart of our being, there is this this craving that is animating our existence. This craving that can never be fulfilled, because as soon as craving grabs onto something, it adapts to that, and that becomes a baseline. It becomes invisible, and the craving remains unsatiated, and it moves on. And the more you contemplate this, the more you recognize that this is something that has to be dealt with. And whether we like it or not, it has to be dealt with, because, you want to be able to see this, because the more clearly you can see this, the more convinced you'll be that this really has to, this is something we have to take responsibility for. This craving is in each one of us, and it's on the loose, and it's moving, it's going. And nobody else can take responsibility for it. Each one of us has this certain movement of craving. And we want to be able to see just to what extent, this really is a conundrum, and B, this really is our responsibility. There's no one else that can do anything about it. So all the different, there's so many different questions. Ajahn Pasno mentioned, what was it? Something about, that's right, the Buddha's talked about the handful of leaves. You know, there's which is greater, the leaves in the forest or the leaves in the Buddha's hands? And of course, the leaves in the forest are infinite, almost. And the leaves in the Buddha's hands are few, but they're what counts. There's this other simile, a fairly well-known simile in to those of us who've studied Buddhism, that the Buddha gives. It's about Malunkyaputta. He's sitting alone, and he's a monk, and he says to himself, you know, there's all these questions that the Buddha doesn't answer, and you know, he doesn't tell me whether or not the body is the same as the soul, or if it's different, or if the universe is eternal, or if it's not eternal. All these different aspects about life that the Buddha doesn't tell me anything about. And this doesn't satisfy me. This doesn't make me happy. So I'm just going to go to the Buddha. I'm going to lay it out straight. I'm going to say, either you tell me the answer to these questions, if you know them, or if you don't know them, then just tell me you don't know them. You know, that's the decent thing to do. And if you're not going to tell me, then I'm going to disrobe. Okay, so he goes to the Buddha, says, you know, Buddha, you say that you know the path, you know everything that needs to be known, and yet you don't tell me the answer to these questions, and I'm not happy about that. And the Buddha says, foolish man. Foolish man. Did I ever say I would answer these questions when you ordained? And he says, well, a good point. That's true. You never said that you... But he says, it's as if Malankyaputta, a man was shot with a poisonous arrow. And, you know, this man was shot with a poisonous arrow and he's on the battlefield and he's dying. And his friends and companions come around and call the doctor to take out the arrow. And the man says, wait, don't take out the arrow. Thank you. That's good. Don't take out the arrow until I know whether the man who shot me is tall or short. And until I know whether the man who shot me is dark-skinned or medium-colored skinned or light-skinned. And also I want to know whether or not the bow that shot me was made from the sinews of a monkey or the sinews of a bird or whatever. And this goes on at quite some length. He said, I don't take out the arrow until I know these things. And the Buddha says that man would die before any solution to that, to those questions was given. And so too, Malankyaputta, I don't teach whether or not the world is eternal or finite. Or I don't teach whether or not the enlightened person lives after death or does not live after death, or both lives and does not live after death, or neither lives nor does not live after death. I don't teach any of these things. And why is that? Because it's not foundational to the spiritual life. But what I teach is suffering and the cessation of suffering. And why is that? Because that's the foundation of, that's what counts, basically. And that's really profound, I think. And in our life, this is the question I think that's before us, is why, what is suffering and why do we suffer? And what can we do about it? And the field where we investigate this is in our meditation. And we have to use the samatha, where we calm the body, we calm the mind. It serves, Ajahn Jayasaro uses the image, it's like a microscope. It's like putting something under a microscope. That's what we do in samatha practice. We're really kind of zooming in on our experience. And cleaning the mind of the five hindrances, I think he uses this, is like cleaning the microscope. You've got to have a clean microscope if you're going to use it. So you take the microscope, you clean it. That means you sit down to develop samatha. You free the mind of the five hindrances, which essentially the five hindrances, you can think of them as just a waste of time. It's a complete waste of time. So just look at it that way, rather than thinking you're missing something. It's just a waste of time. So put down the five hindrances. When it comes to things like doubt, sometimes I've heard a few people in the questions say doubt is attacking them. Just give yourself the freedom, just for these next five, you have 5 days left, and just pretend you don't have any doubt. That's a good, skillful means. Because doubt serves the purpose of just holding you back. You know, assuming you have enough information, and everyone who's come here has enough information to try it out, doubt simply holds you back. And there's a lot of there's a lot to be experienced in the meditative journey that you're blocking yourself off from simply through doubting. And so what you can do with doubt is, this is one aside, just pretend you don't have any doubt. And just for 5 days, you can doubt all you want after the retreat, but just for 5 days, say, okay, I'm going to pretend that there's no doubt, and let's just see what happens. And you'll see that actually a lot can unfold simply on the basis of giving yourself a break from doubt. At any rate, so back to the simile of the microscope, cleaning the lens, freeing your mind from the five hindrances, and then investigating the relationship between, well, this background in our being, this background thirst that is constantly, can never be satisfied. That's there because we've picked up this body, and we've identified with this body, and that identification goes very, very deep. So we have to find these different tools: investigation of death, investigation of the elements of the body, where we just see this body, try and see it just exactly what it is, as an organism, literally as an organism. And another one, which is a bit more sort of less, what's the word? Appealing, perhaps is the word, is corpse contemplation. Very powerful contemplation if you've ever seen a dead body, especially one that happens to be decomposing. It can be an incredible experience to see how a body simply goes from being what was once a human being, say a friend, somebody you know, or someone you've seen before, and then to see it gradually decay and return literally to the earth element is an amazing thing. And probably not many of you have seen that, but you can imagine it. Just this aspect of the body returning back to the earth. And there's something in that visual image which affects the attachment. There's something that's so strong about that perception that the attachment to the body is loosened, if not abandoned. And in that letting go, I mean, this is where in that letting go is, as Ajahn Pasen was pointed to, is the highest happiness, freedom from suffering, freedom from doubt. Imagine what that would be like to be free from. I mean, you look across the landscape, the human beings on this planet, one could very easily despair, like the amount of different opinions about, say, the spiritual life, and it's just overwhelming. It seems like there's, you know, millions of different views about what life is all about. And to actually be free from doubt as to what the essence of the spiritual path is, what its fruits are, and not to be simply reverting to some kind of dogmatism, but to actually to have seen it for yourself, that's something I believe is actually possible. And it's not something that not something that's easy, but it's something that's possible and something worth committing to, even if it takes, frankly, even if it takes lifetimes. That doesn't deter me, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that it will take lifetimes, because it's hard work. So I think maybe I'll end the talk there.